Lastly, Your Excellency, the Prime Minister, Honorable Ministers, Dashios, our distinguished speaker, Dr. Tan Khi Kia, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the second lecture of the 9th RICS Anniversary Lecture Series. Under the benevolent and far-sighted leadership of His Majesty the King, RICS was established 9 years ago in October 2013 as a leadership institute and a think tank. Inspired by His Majesty's vision, leadership and service to our country and our people, we have designed and offered several different programs over the past 9 years with the primary objective of promoting excellence in governance and leadership. And we continue to do so with renewed vigor and zeal as our country undertakes major transformative initiatives focused on progress, prosperity, and people towards achieving our new vision of becoming a developed nation within the shortest time frame possible. As we commemorate our 9th anniversary, we are happy to bring to you the 9th RICS Anniversary Lecture Series, which started yesterday. The series of lectures this week are inspired by a book Ambassador Tommy Koh of Singapore edited called The 50 Secrets of Singapore's Success. Therefore, the overall theme of the lecture series is Nation Building Lessons from Singapore's Success. And the four lectures under the series by different speakers will dwell on different aspects of Singapore's success as a nation that we can draw from. We are deeply grateful to Ambassador Tommy Koh for not only agreeing to be a speaker in this lecture series, but also in recommending and introducing us to the distinguished speakers we have in the lineup. By the way, Ambassador Koh's Friday Forum lecture is coming up on the 14th of October. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, for today we are happy and honored to have Dr. Tan Khi Kia to talk on factors behind Singapore's economic achievements, a subject that is undoubtedly relevant to us in Bhutan as we aggressively pursue economic growth and prosperity to achieve our new vision of becoming a developed country. We are also honored and thankful to have Mr. Kamat Singh, the Honorable Secretary of the Ministry of Economic Affairs, to moderate the session today. So without further ado, let me hand over to our moderator to introduce our speaker and begin the session. So over to you, La.
Thank you, Tom. Your Excellency, the Prime Minister of Bhutan, the Honorable Ministers, Dashios, Dr. Tan, our speaker for today's webinar lecture, joining online from Singapore, senior officials of the Royal Government of Bhutan, ladies and gentlemen, who are attending this afternoon's webinar lecture series organized by RICS on Nation Building, Lessons from Singapore's Experience, with today's theme as factors behind Singapore's economic achievements, as already cited by RICS Director. I would like to thank RICS for giving me the opportunity and honor to introduce our esteemed speaker for today's talk, who is none other than Professor Tan Khi Kia. Tan Khi Kia is currently the chairman of the Singapore National Committee for Pacific Economic Cooperation, SINGPEC. Upon graduating with a PhD from University of East Anglia, England in 1987, under the Overseas Research Scheme awarded by the Committee of Vice Chancellors and Principals of the University of the United Kingdom, he joined the banking sector as a treasury manager and served as secretary to the Assets and Liabilities Committee for 3 years. Thereafter, Professor taught at the Department of Economics and Statistics, National University of Singapore, during 1990 to 1993. Dr. Tan joined Nanyang Technological University in 1993 and was Associate Dean, Graduate Studies Office during 2007 to 2009. He was Associate Professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, National University of Singapore from 2009 till 2022, and also Co-Director of the Asian Competitiveness Institute from 2011 to 2020. Dr. Tan has consulted extensively with the various government ministries, statutory boards, and government-linked companies of Singapore government, including the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Trade and Industry, Minister of Manpower, Housing and Development Board, Civil Aviation Authority of Singapore, Singapore Tourism Board, State Development Board, Maritime Port Authority, Ministry of Information, Culture and Arts, Economic Development Board, Ministry of National Development, Media Development Authority, Ministry of Environment and Water Resources, Singapore Design Council, Ministry of Community Development, Youth and Sports, Singapore Press Holdings, Yayasan Mindaki Startup, Capital Land and Green Eastern Life. He has also served as a consultant to international agencies such as the ADB, ADB Institute, UN Industrial Development Group, World Bank Group, World Gold Council, ASEAN Secretariat, Central Policy Unit of Hong Kong, Kersner International, Las Vegas Sands and Marina Bay Sands, and Suzhou International Park Authority. Dr. Tan is the lead author for more than 20 books, serving as journal editors published widely in international referred journals. He is the associate editor of the journal Review of Pacific Basin Financial Markets and Policies, US-based, and on the editorial advisory board of the journal Competitiveness Review, UK-based. His current research interests include cost of living and purchasing power index of world's 105 cities, Global Livable Cities Index, which Professor will touch later in the presentation, Ease of Doing Business Index, and Competitiveness Analysis on Non-National Economies, Sub-National Economies of China, India, Indonesia, and ASEAN. Dr. Tan was Deputy President of the Singapore Economic Society in 2004. He served in the 2002 Economic Review Committee, served as Chairman of the Task Force on Portable Medical Benefits, served as the Deputy Chairman of the IPS Forum for Economic Restructuring in 2003, and also served as a member of Resource Panel of the Government Parliamentary Committee for Transport and Government Parliamentary Committee for Finance and Trade and Industry and Government Parliamentary Committee for Defense and Foreign Affairs since 2007. Dr. Tan is currently an independent director of the public listed Bosted Singapore Limited, Lian Bang Group Limited, SN Bridge Limited, and non-publicly listed Red Talk Group Private Limited. He is also the Senior Business Advisor to GN Weish Culture and Media Singapore Private Limited. He also was the Senior Business Advisor to United Overseas Bank Limited Singapore and Independent Director at the state-owned Chengdu Rural Commercial Bank Company Limited in China. With this brief introduction, and before I give the floor to Dr. Tan, let me set the context of today's talk by saying a few words about Singapore's economic success that I know of from various sources. As we all know, Singapore became an independent nation on August 9, 1965. Over five decades ago, Singapore had nothing, and now it is one of the most successful economic transformation stories, with one of the highest per capita income in the world of close to US$79,000, which is much higher than United Kingdom's GDP at US$49,000. Despite its physical limitations of being geographically half the size of Thimphu District in Bhutan, but with 6 million people, again, with 3 million immigrants, which is small in a world of 7 billion, Singapore, that little red dot, is an economic powerhouse in East Asia and a major hub for global trade and finance. A GDP of almost half a trillion US dollars makes Singapore bigger than the GDP of all SAARC countries put together except India, whose population is over 400 million. Singapore offers Bhutan valuable lessons of how a nation with no resources at all was able to build one of the most stable, wealthy, and developed countries in five decades, a process that took the West over 300 years. Many say that Singapore is strategically located in the waterways of the world and hence the inherent advantage. But so are many other countries, including our own neighbor, Sri Lanka, for example. And yet, Singapore is the one who emerged successful while the others face unprecedented economic and social challenges. Therefore, what made the difference for Singapore is one key fundamental lesson that Bhutan needs to learn and adapt as we embark on a major economic transformation of our country. On this note, I would now like to hand over the report to Dr. Tan. Dr. Tan, you have up to 60 minutes to deliver your lecture. And we will let Professor complete presentation first, and Q&A will be following after the presentation. So therefore, if you have questions, please note your questions for posting after the presentation. A format for question and answer will be shared later. Professor Tan, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chairman, Your Excellency Prime Minister of Bhutan, Honorable Ministers, ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to allow to share something about development of Singapore. Initially, that the title was about secrets of Singapore's economic development. And I told the organizer there's no secret, but rather factors that contribute to Singapore's development. As you know, the important factors are the leaders and the people. I think this is basically what I'm going to talk about today for the 60 minutes. Let me share the screen with you. Yes, I hope you can see the screen.
Yes, Professor. Can you click on the slideshow?
Is it? Oh, okay.
Yes, yes, Professor.
Okay.
Yes, we can.
This is the presentation I usually do for the government civil servants, and just about less than 2 weeks ago, I did it for the Singapore Ministry of Home Affairs, where the civil servants attended this course. And today, I'm sharing with you on a broader approach than I talk to our Singapore civil servants, because I think Bhutan and Singapore is very different. But I recognize that Bhutan, like Singapore, you don't have the kind of rich resources that many countries are being endowed with. But I think there is something we can share here in terms of Singapore's development. That is about leadership, the civil servants, and the people. Okay, so today, I start by sharing with you what Singapore's nickname when we were in Indonesia. I think the Indonesian leader told Singapore that you are a little red dot. Yeah, we are so small on the map, we are a little red dot. But I think before I start, I must share with you the wisdom of our founding father, the late Minister Mentor Lee Kuan Yew. He repeatedly reminded all Singaporeans that no one owes us a living. That's very important. Nobody owes us a living. And the survival of Singapore hinges on how we collectively, as one united people, to constantly remake Singapore, to make ourselves relevant. Now, this is a very simple statement, but not easy to understand, but I'll elaborate more. That as a small country without resources, we have to constantly remake Singapore to make Singapore relevant to the rest of the world. And not only that, we have to stay three steps ahead of our competitors. This is basically what Lee Kuan Yew reminded us from day one, even until his last part of his life. I think this is something we need to bear in mind. Now we can see Lee Kuan Yew. Singapore then is like many developing countries. You have forests, you have nothing. And you can see our current prime minister, he's the one in front of Lee Kuan Yew with a small camera. And then you see Dr. Goh Keng Swee. I think it is the architect of Singapore's development. He was the deputy prime minister and worked together with Lee Kuan Yew as a prime minister since we have independence. And you know that Lee Kuan Yew studied in Raffles College, which is currently the campus of Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. And our deputy prime minister, Dr. Goh Keng Swee, then was tutor in Raffles College, which is at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, the second campus of National University of Singapore. Now you can see why I show you this. This is one of the suburban at the western side of Singapore. And you know, from time to time, not just cities are developed, but you have to renew and make over the city. So development of Singapore as an urban cosmopolitan, the development will never stop because you always have to upgrade. You always have to continue to keep up with the time. Now, I show this slide. This slide is of a very important significance. And you know, Marina Bay Sands is an integrated resort. 13 bidders bid for this project. I happen to be the advisor together with the president of Las Vegas Sands. We bid for this project and currently it's very successful. And why I bring this up? The point I want to make is this. If you make a correct public policy, like the Marina Bay Sands Integrated Resort, the land surrounding the Marina Bay Sands appreciated so much. So much so that when I was a consultant to Maritime Port Authority of Singapore, I did suggest to move the ports to the western side of the island. But at that time, the government thinks that it costs too much money. Billions of dollars will be involved in the moving of the port from the city to the western side of the island. But because of one correct public policy, which is an integrated resort, now you know it's Marina Bay Sands, the land appreciated so much. So now government is the first to gain from land appreciation. So we have more than enough to move the port to the western side of the island without having to pay for it, because the land around Marina Bay Sands has appreciated significantly. So it is important that you must get the public policy right. And if you do that, the spin-over effect to the entire economy, and it will last for a very long time. So public policy is of utmost importance. And this is what we study and teach in Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. Now, very quickly, I have presentation outline, but I'm not going to go through those, all of them, but those who are, I think, relevant for Bhutan, I'll try to highlight a little bit more. Now, I'm going to talk about the position of Singapore among the selected economy in the world, and also the international report cards of Singapore, and why the development of Singapore is not based on the textbook case. You know, many people come to Singapore and ask our leaders how to develop Singapore. And we always tell them development ought to be pragmatic and it cannot be copied from the textbook. And if you want a good development formula, you can find it in the World Bank, you can find it in the International Monetary Fund. But I think what is more important is not the recipe for development, but rather the leaders and the civil servants who implement policies and the people who trust the government. I think this is very important. I'm going to share a little bit more. Then as you develop, all the developing countries now, they realize we cannot ignore the three sibling elephants in the room. Because if you ignore them, it will be unsustainable and it will be socially unstable. And the three sibling elephants which are related to one another, I'm talking about, is income disparity, affordability of public services, and also the local foreign worker mix. Now, I think in Bhutan, you would have to pay attention to income disparity. You have to pay attention to whether public services are affordable, and you have to pay attention when you have foreign tourists or you have foreign workers, what would be the optimum mix? Because it will create tension. And Singapore have learned through difficult experiences, which I would like to share. Then now you know the economy, the world economy is in unprecedented challenges. Not just the COVID, but the rapid technological progress. So as a cosmopolitan city, Singapore have to watch what are the challenges ahead. And we have to act on it before the challenge put us into a difficult position. So how to transform the economy? How to face the new normal. What happens if the growth slows down? So in that sense, we have to have long-term strategy development. But the long-term strategy development of Singapore must be based on core competence and pragmatic consideration to stay relevant. So I will share with you how we build a cosmopolitan city, how we globalize, how to ensure the development is inclusive and sustainable. There are five basic principles for public policy formulation, which I share with you. Then I want to talk about for effective public policy communication and operational efficiency. Civil servants are very important. And the civil servants' ability to address blind spots, civil servants' ability not to be in groupthink, that means all things along one direction. I think that's very dangerous. I will share with you. And I also talk about the challenge in the post-COVID-19 and how Singapore, in this difficult time, Singapore must not choose sides. Singapore must be friends with everybody. Now, this is basically the rough of what the scope of what I'm going to present today. And very quickly, I can show you. If in terms of the economic size, Singapore is not that big. We're about 35. I think we are bigger than Malaysia now with all this Singapore dollars appreciation. This is all measured in US dollars. We maybe now is about 34, maybe slightly bigger than Hong Kong now. Right? You can see, but in terms of per capita, we are number 9 in the world. But I think, as you know, with this COVID and then also the appreciation of Singapore dollars, we probably are just slightly higher than United States of America in terms of per capita, right? And you can see the rest of ASEAN countries behind us. They're competing with us. And newly industrialized economies of Taiwan, Hong Kong, South Korea, yes, we must stay 3 steps ahead of them. And that's very important because competition is very intensive nowadays. Now I share with you some international report cards. And before that, we can look at the cost of living, wages, and purchasing power and livability. Now, before that, I think it's very important for any country, especially for Bhutan, you must monitor your cost of living. You must look at the wages. You must look at the purchasing power. And I think Bhutan, if I understand it correctly, you do set certain number of tourists that can visit Bhutan per year. And I think that's very important because you don't want to make Bhutan not livable. So livability, environmental sustainability, and a green Bhutan is really your assets. So it is very important leaders have to think in terms of cost of living, the salary that one gets, how strong is the purchasing power, and are they livable? Now, this is a report card of Singapore that although we are very small, but consistently we rank top either in terms of digital economy. Now, I want to point to you a statistic which is quite surprising for many, that in terms of receiving foreign direct investment, and this is the latest figure by IMF, Singapore is number 1 with 72 billion, China number 2, 42 billion, and Indonesia 12.5 billion. Now, but in terms of top contribution of foreign direct investment, Japan is 264 billion US, Singapore is 217 billion over time, and US 134 billion. Now, as the world's freest economy, Singapore is number 2. As a financial center, we are now number 3, overtaking Hong Kong just recently. And least risky country to invest, we consistently are the top in the world. And the least corrupt country, and I'm talking about civil servants, I'm talking about leaders. Singapore is the least corrupt country in the world. And least corrupt, sorry, in Asia, but number 7 in the world. And you can look at purchasing power. We are number 16 in the world, but number 1 in Asia. Now, we're talking about purchasing power. We're talking about purchasing power, ordinary resident. When you talk about cost of living, our attention is on cost of living of ordinary resident, not expatriate. So I leave it to you to read what else in our international report card. But you can see here, ordinary residents, you look at the chart, and you can see Singapore. Singapore is over here. So it is good to be in this up right-hand corner. Singapore is here, which is cost of living index versus livable city. So you want to be here, so you are livable, and you want your cost of living to be as low. So Singapore is in a very good position. We are talking about ordinary residents, not the cost of living expatriate. So Singapore's ordinary residents' cost of living, as you can see here, they are not high, but they are highly livable. Okay, so you can see. And if you look at housing, utilities, and transport, you know, in terms of the cost and also the standard, and Singapore also not bad in this area, and you can see developing Asia around here. Now, in case you say, how I draw the line, yeah, I didn't draw the line to make Singapore in. This line is the median line. And you can see in terms of educational cost index and education as a public services, Singapore is doing okay. Now, health cost index versus public service standard, Singapore need to improve a little bit more than what it is now, right? And purchasing power. Singapore's purchasing power is very strong. Not only is strong, and is highly livable, as you can see on the top right-hand corner. Now, this is a book we published on the livable cities, and the World Bank supported our studies, and we did it not just for the 70 over livable city in the world. We also do the 100 Greater China cities in terms of livability. And you can see that Singapore, we rank quite high compared to many European countries. We update them every 2-3 years. And we will not go into the detail, but I can show you that those top cities in the world, in terms of livability, they are Japanese city, Singapore, Hong Kong. So basically the top 20, these are the few Asian cities which are considered livable. So this is our book on cost of living, wages, and purchasing power. And many people say Singapore is expensive. Yes, it's expensive for expatriate if you want to own a car. You want to stay in the private housing. You want to dine in the restaurants. They are expensive. But if you were to stay in public housing and you have lunch and dinner at the hawker centers and you take public transport of buses and MRT, Singapore is not expensive. So I leave it to you for those who are interested. The details is in the book. But you can see in terms of geographical regions, many of the cost of living for ordinary residents, you can see on the top right-hand corner, based on many Asian and Chinese cities. Right? So I will not go into this detail. You can look at it yourself. But I think I want to talk about Singapore as a highly open cosmopolitan cities. You know, Singapore is one country with two economies. One is international economy versus domestic economy. And there are three classes of people in Singapore, and I call them the wealthy privileged class. This is about 1%. Then you have 84% who are middle class, consisting of managers, professional, executive, and technicians. And of course, as a professor from a university, I'm part of the middle class, in fact, upper middle class. So when you have a strong middle class, the country will be stable. And we have an economic social underclass, which is about 15%. So it is very important. You have a middle class, you have a stable society. And here I quote Lee Kuan Yew again. Lee Kuan Yew say that if you get an alternative government, go in and out of power. And it's very difficult. There's no policy continuity. And if you start to argue and debate instead of development, jobs will be in peril, and then your property asset will go down, and the people ended up as foreign workers abroad. So Lee Kuan Yew warned us in 2007. So it is very important that the objective of any government is to create a big, stable middle class. Now, Singapore's developed, I think the chairman very aptly summarized just now. In the 1960s, we have a Jurong Town Council, and how we want to build up an industrial estate close to the public housing estate, because you know why at that time Singapore had massive unemployment. Our immediate objective is to create jobs for the people. But you know, in 1960s, the left wing was widespread, multinational was not welcome. But Lee Kuan Yew and his team make a decision that employment creation is more important than political ideology. And at that time, multinational corporations, according to the lefties, exploit the people. But I think we took the very pragmatic approach that when you are poor, there's not much to exploit except your labor. And then our young population, with those educated with tertiary education, who joined the multinational to learn how to manage international companies. And we will have our labor who are in the intensive industry, when they get a job, they can afford a public housing. Now, this is very important. When you get a job, you have a public housing, and we have a forced savings central provident fund. So that when the economy grows, and if you own the public housing from day one, over the years, as the economy grows bigger, and the price of your public housing will also appreciate. So this is one way where the growth of an economy is translated into the assets appreciation of the ordinary people. And that gives you the social stability. In 1970s, we continued to achieve rapid economic growth. Our 60s and 70s, we were growing almost like China, nearly double digit, 9.0%. But 1980s, I think we are starting to upgrade our industrial parks. And then the technology came in. And then in the 2000, we had to plan. Since Singapore is a very small country with 720 over square kilometers, we had to plan to make our city livable. A place where you can work, live and play. It's not easy, you know. And from 2010 onwards, we have a master plan on land use for very long term. And you can see from here that you see in the 60 to 86, we grow by 86%. 87 to 97, we grow by 9.3%. But you can see 1998 to 2008, we are just 4.6%. And I think for the next 2021 to 2030, if we do it right, we can still have 3% per annum in the new digitalized transformation development phase. Now, in this latest development, we worry less about industrial pollution, because if we produce electric car and you need highly qualified engineers. And if we have a semiconductor industry, we need engineers. But these are not highly polluting. And so we need to plan, because now this kind of factory can blend in with the populations. They are no longer than those in the 60s and 70s which are highly polluted. So as the economy develops from state to stage, there are at least six fundamental questions we must always ask ourselves. Not only the people must ask themselves, the leaders and the civil servant must ask these six fundamental questions. And then the number one, what should be the role of the government in ensuring an inclusive society? No point having development where the rich become richer, the poor become poorer. So in that sense, Singapore is a very socialist country, because 85% of Singaporeans own their public housing. 92% stay in the public housing. So we have to make sure that the role of the government is to produce an inclusive society. Look at China now. After rapid development, income disparity gave us, China now is talking about common prosperity. So that's the role of the government, because you depend on market sources. those rich tend to get richer, the poor tend to get poorer. So we need a government, not just the government, but the government must stay on for a long period of time to ensure continuity of the public policy, both in terms of formulation and also in terms of implementation. Now, second question you must ask, and this is Lee Kuan Yew's question, that no one owes us a living. How can we stay united and make Singapore relevant in this tumultuous global environment? Now, how we stay united? So if you have a two-party system, there will be disaster for small country, you know. Then you argue until the cow come home, there's no solution. So we need a strong government that promotes inclusiveness, a strong government that makes sure that by the end of the day, the people, majority of them, are getting a better life than before. We can't make sure all the people, we've got to make sure majority of the people, at least 80% and above of the people, must feel their life is better. Three, how could we best defend Singapore against our neighbors and among global players? Now, if your country develops, but you are not able to defend yourself, I think that's making you very vulnerable. And then, fundamental question number four, you must identify what are the aspirations and expectations of the people, cutting across all age groups. What does the people want? You must stay close to the people. And how effective civil servants can formulate, manage, articulate, and communicate public policy to the public at large. Now, many people thought civil servants, if you formulate good policy, manage them, is good enough. I said, no. The most difficult part is when you have a good policy, how you articulate and communicate to the public in a language that they can understand. Otherwise, you know, it makes no sense. You can formulate policy, but you cannot explain. You cannot articulate in a language that they understand, and you will fail. Right? And how effective civil servant I talk about. Then the last one, what is the appropriate role of public institution at the different phases of Singapore's economic development? So these are the six other questions. And you can see how Singapore moving up from stage to stage. And now we are beyond. So you have this one-off industrial park, knowledge-based economy. And I just came back from Suzhou Industrial Park in China about 10 days ago. I'm shocked that the kind of development in Suzhou, they have overtaken Singapore in many areas in terms of livable cities, in terms of green and sustainability, in terms of smart building, in terms of technology progress. So even for a city like Suzhou, which Singapore worked very closely with, they try to overtake Singapore in many areas. We have regional headquarters. They also want to have regional headquarters. But what I found over the last 25 years, and going to be 30 years by 2024, the success of Suzhou Industrial Park is due to leaders and very able civil servants in China. That they are able to implement and explain policy to the public at large. So I have to emphasize, development of Singapore is not based on secrets. It's not based on recipes. But it's based on leadership. They are able to carry through policy by civil servants and enjoy the trust of the people. So you can see how we move. And I went through this with you just now. So what is the role of the government? The role of the government, it is an economic facilitator. It is a social equalizer. It's a political stabilizer. So it's very important. You want to facilitate economic role, but not to take over the market. You want to ensure there is a social equalizer, and I think through education. And you want to have a political stability, which means that it's good to have opposition, but a two-party system will make life very difficult for government to govern. So I think the system must be able to absorb the ablest, the brightest to join the government so that you have a credible government to run the country so that you can win election, there will be political stability. But of course, when Singapore went to the extreme, the brightest and ablest go to the government, and we find ourselves not having enough entrepreneurs. And when you join civil service with a very good, stable lifestyle and salary, you find people in their comfort zone. They are not willing to take risks. So this is some of the problem we face. So in developed the economies, there are some natural cluster. That means you have the advantage. That is called natural cluster. But Singapore, very often, we have to promote certain cluster because we don't have natural resources. So many people get confused when you create cluster or when you promote cluster. It is not to pick which winners, because civil servant cannot pick winners. You make mistake because businessman is better at picking winners. So instead of picking certain industry, you might pick the wrong industry. Now, at one time, we picked semiconductor, but the timing was wrong. Semiconductor prices were squeezed. We lose a lot of money. So we learned not to pick winners. But we have been doing hosting winners. Hosting winner means that you get the top company of a cluster to come to Singapore, make sure they have stable labor relationship, no strikes, have a stable supply of electricity and water. I make sure the foreigner here, the expatriate, can have a good lifestyle that they are comfortable with. We put them together and we build up and learn their management knowledge, and then let the local people slowly be able to create our own multinational. So picking winners is not easy for civil servant, but hosting winners, many people say, can you tell me something easier to understand hosting winner? Oh, if you are in Singapore, you know, Singapore have a world-class horse racing club near north of the country. Now, we create an infrastructure where the lighting will change with the weather, and the water of the grass will change with the temperature and the rainfall. This is a world class. But we never bet on horses. We let those who like horse to keep their horse here, we tax them. Those who can ride horses, we tax their personal income. Those who like to bet on horses, we let them bet. Whether they win or lose, we tax. So we host them together. We create jobs, but we don't get involved in the horse racing or horse betting. So this is called hosting winners. So when you host winner, there is a 555 rule, which comes from our senior civil servant, Philip Yeo. He said, every time you bring in an industry, it takes 5 years to develop, then 5 years to mature and plateau, and 5 years it will decline. So you see, civil servants, you have to constantly, if you are very open economy, constantly think of new clusters, how you can prepare the new cluster when the old cluster start to slow down. And this is one example of the data industry. Then you know, the first 5 years, it was only 1.6 billion, and it went to 13 billion. And to you know, cumulative 178 billion, but after 5 years, it start to go downhill. And you have to look for a new one. So Singapore, we now have semiconductor industry, electronic getting bigger. We're looking at electric car industry. So we're looking at services industry, tourism. This is why the integrated resort. And we're looking at cryptocurrency, fintech, startup, you know. So these are how the different classes of Singapore. And it is important that we have to match the human resource with economic development. You know, innovation is very important. Now we have 6 universities. Now, investing in education is not welfare. Investing in education, one should subsidize the education. Because you subsidize the education, you subsidize the people. It's very important. Yeah. So, not only we have to look for foreign talent because we are too small, and how to meet them, how to understand them, how to nurture them, how to utilize them, how to measure them, how to reward them, how to appreciate them, how to accommodate them, and how to retain them. I mean, Singapore started with less than 2 million. Now we have about 5.5 million, of which 1.5 million are foreigner, white collar and blue collar. So we should look at the foreign workforce. The blue collar, we allow them to rotate, and we get a younger one every time when the blue collar worker get older. So we rotate them. But for white collar foreign workers, we must retain them, integrate them. They can become permanent residents. Later on, they can become citizens. Excuse me. That's how we make Singapore grow through innovation and creativity. So we have a high-tech development plan. We have all kind of Asia Innovation Award, Council for Research, National Research Foundation. And you see, we collaborate with world-class institute of higher learning. And one should not be afraid to talk about foreign talent. You know, ordinary people, sometimes they feel defensive. If you get foreign workers to come here, especially the white collar, they say, no, they take away our jobs. But we must be able to convince them, the more talented white collar workers we have, we can make the Singapore economy bigger. We can create more jobs for Singaporeans to be in, for example, financial centers. These are high value added, high salary jobs. But we need top bankers in the world. And you make them the citizen, like the CEO of a development bank of Singapore. I think he's now Singaporean. And by making development bank of Singapore bigger, you have more Singaporeans who can learn to be in the top management of banking. And then you can create a local core of banking staff that allow them to have high salary. Now, then we need the talent. You know, A-Star have this policy to create 2-1 billion, to have 1,000 PhDs, everyone a million, so that they help to sustain the Singapore life sciences cluster, pharmaceutical cluster, chemical industry cluster, electric car cluster, you know, semiconductors. So we have to manage and attract talents. And I talk about the three sibling elephants. Now, very often this elephant is in the room, but we shouldn't pretend to say they are not there because they are too obvious. So one is income disparity, and the other one is whether public services are affordable. When I talk about public services, it must be housing, public education, public transportation, you know, and utility. These are important public services. Healthcare. And this is the second element. And the third one is the mix between indigenous, that means local and foreign manpower. Now, these three elephants, they are siblings, they're brothers and sisters. They are linked together because one elephant, if you are not careful, they grow in size, like income disparity, they get worse. Then public services become not affordable. And if you have too many foreigners, the local cannot get meaningful employment with meaningful pay. So they get poorer. So these are all three sibling elephants related. Then we have to keep their size in check. Otherwise, there will not be social harmony. There will not be political stability. So government have to have a proactive role. Now, one way to redistribute the wealth in a country is through the budget, right? And I won't talk too much about the budget except to say that for many countries, they like to use the budget as a way to give the people money, especially the general election is near. These are soft public policy options. Soft. They're just popular. They just spend money. But eventually, where does the money come from? Welfare state is a terrible form of the government budgeting. You know, Singapore never believed in welfare. Singapore believe in workfare. So if you are unemployed in Singapore, you get nothing from the government. But if you stay employed, because our salary is lower than $2,300 a month, Singapore say, I help you under workfare income supplement. I supplement you the difference between your current wage and the living wage, which is $2,300 a month. So this is a way to discourage welfare and to promote workfare. And the people must not be inward looking. They must be outward looking, because we are going to be a cosmopolitan city. So you can look at Singapore's growth. You can see they're up and down, but they are trending downwards because we are maturing, right? And for 2002, government think the GDP growth be 3 to 5%, but I think it can be around 4%. 2021, during our COVID, our economy still grow at 7.6, but it was contracting in 2020. And now we learn to live with virus. We are almost back to normal. So I think how Singapore can achieve a good control of the COVID-19 is, in the first place, people trust the government. The people take vaccination. People observe the rules set by the government. And government help companies to tide over difficult times. But you see, to be able to cope with COVID-19, 2020, Singapore spent 100 billion. So in other words, when it comes to development, when it comes to budgeting, if you are a poor country, you are in trouble. So how to be prudent in your budget? How to accumulate wealth or government surplus? How to manage the government surplus? Then how to redistribute the government surplus, which is very important. This is the fundamental role of the government, to help to accumulate government surplus for the country, to manage them well, and to redistribute them fairly. Now, these are some of the policy in the latest budget, which I will not go into. I leave it for you to read. But you know, net investment return contribution, I want to talk a little bit about this. You look at Singapore's budget, the green color. Green color are net income return from contribution from government investment corporation, Temasek Holdings, and Monetary Authority of Singapore. Now, I wrote it out, over the last 20 years, it contributed 27 billion to our budget every year, about 2.7 billion over, you know, these 20 years. In fact, 10 years is 27 billion. 20 years will be 54 billion. Sorry, yeah, it's not 27. It should be 54 billion. And why we can do that? Two special transfer, and we can lower our Gini coefficient, right? From 0.45 to 0.35 in 2021. Why we can do that? Because we have term budget. The Monetary Authority of Singapore have 403 billion of foreign exchange reserve. Our GICs have 966 billion, almost 1 trillion. And our Temasek have more than 1 trillion. You see, it is very important. You manage the government well with surpluses, with no corruptions. This is how the medium household income have risen, you know, from 8,292, you know, to 9,245 for different income bracket. And you see Gini coefficient goes down. So making housing affordable, I talked to you about welfare income supplement, I leave it to read for the detail. And then for the older people, we have a different packages to help the aging population. Now you can't help the aging population if you have no money, you know, it's very important. So we also have economic plan. No, Singapore don't just grow by market forces. Many of the development we have is through Economic Strategy Committee, Committee for Future Economy, Committee for Post-Pandemic Economy Transformation. Maybe we should have one coming next year. But the point I want to say is this. You involve the private sector, involve the academic, involve the civil servants, and the leaders must make decision to charter the growth ahead. Every time when we have a crisis, global financial tsunami, we have one. So I think it is important, and I will not go into the detail because He's very Singaporean. But there are two different types of strategies. One is the red ocean strategies, and one is the blue ocean strategies. So I, for one moment, I don't believe that a government should cut down expenditure all the time. That's red ocean strategy, because there's a limit the amount of government expenditure you can cut. For aging population, you can't even cut government expenditure because healthcare is more expensive now. But I think the correct way is a blue ocean strategy. The blue ocean strategy is so how to enhance the revenue of the budget, how the manpower skill of the people can be deepened, how we can be innovative driven to have new clusters. So looking at the income side, generate the government revenue, I think is more more fruitful than trying to cut the expenditure. Cutting an expenditure is the red ocean strategy. So blue ocean strategy, you need not just being innovative, you need to invest in the people, and you need leaders to see the where the future growth will come from. Right? So this is how wages and productivity, competitiveness, you know, Singapore will go through A, C, D. That means low wage, low productivity, then low wage, high productivity, high wage, high productivity. But the West take the other way, A, B, D. Low wage, low productivity, high wage, low productivity, then high wage, high productivity. So the European country you can see, and the US, the worker is always on strike. And Singapore is to convince a multinational, and our workers will not be on strike because we have a tripartite committee where government, employers, and employees work together to make sure that we are productive, we are competitive, and the wages will reflect the skill of the manpower. Now, I must say this, you know, to make an economy grow, you need to have a strong leader. Now, Lee Kuan Yew is very strong in 1987. This is what he said, but I don't think our current leaders will repeat what Lee Kuan Yew says. You know, Lee Kuan Yew say, I say without the slightest remorse that we wouldn't be here. We would not have made economic progress if we had not intervened on very personal matters. Who your neighbors is, how you live, the noise you make, how you speak, or what language you use. We decide what is right, never mind what the people think. Now, this is not possible now with a more educated Singaporean. But Lee Kuan Yew was very, very, very courageous. He wanted to have a strong government to push Singapore to a higher growth. And later on, when education improved for the people, our second Prime Minister, Goh Chok Tong, decided to be more consultative, right? And now, after Lee Hsien Loong and the fourth generation leaders say, we have to engage the people. We call Singapore conversation. Talk to the people, understand what they want. So I will not go through each of the committee because they are very detailed. You can read it yourself. But I want to highlight digital capability, whether you like it or not, whether you are in Bhutan or whether you are in Africa or whether you are in very competitive Asia. Digital capability is the only way to go. Many developing countries jump the fixed phone era, go straight to handphone, and handphone now displays notebook, displays so many of our electronic gadgets. So digital capability, the payment system. Now, I went to China, I was shocked. And nobody want my Chinese RMB because everybody use digital e-payment. I'm ashamed to say that the taxi driver refused to get my payment because I pay cash. And he said, I rather don't want your cash. So he just drove away because to get me the cash back is too time consuming for him. So now there are some wisdom of Minister Mentor, and I told you that nobody owes a living. But now in 2015, Singapore celebrate 50 years of independence. So there are the three way of approaching public policy for SGAT. SG80 means that you add another 30 years to 2015, so 2045. We must think in terms of 30 years from now, if you are a civil servant. So we have to reassess Singapore's public policy in the post-Lee Kuan Yew era. We must explore what was relevant in the past, continue to be relevant today, and likely to be so in the future. And I think globalization is the only way to go. Although globalization now have a bit of problem, I think this is a correct policy in the past, correct policy now, and will continue to be correct in the future. So we must identify public policy of this sort. And the second research cluster which we look at is public policy which was correct in the past, but because circumstances and conditions have changed, how we can fine-tune our welfare income supplement is an important fine-tuning. That we don't like welfare, we want workfare. So this is a second example. Think of policies that you have to fine-tune because condition and circumstances have changed. The last one is the post-Lee Kuan Yew era. A lot of policies, they emerged only after Lee Kuan Yew passed away in 2015. So what are they? Well, we have to think very long term. Like the Isthmus of Clark Canal. That if they were to build this canal across the tip of Thailand and Malaysia, how is Singapore port going to be affected? With the thing of the Belt and Road Initiative, how Singapore can be part of it. So you see, Singapore is planning to build our Terminal 5 because we think that air transport will be the next explosion in the world. So you see, in the post-Lee Kuan Yew era, we are looking at emerging trends, right? So very quickly, I think my time may be running out. I want to talk about how Singapore's strategy development must be based on our core competence and must also have pragmatic consideration. So this is our financial hub, right? And I'm saying that we should think of a way that how Singapore can build our society to be inclusive and to be family-oriented in a multiracial, multicultural, and multi-religious settings. And how SMEs can be relevant in the financial sector, not just multinational. So I have detailed proposal how can make SMEs to enjoy our Singapore as a financial center. Then I want to look at the governance, financial accounting standards, how the financial center can balance the stakeholders. No point having a financial center when the rich become richer, the poor become poorer. So we have some of the suggestions below. So how Singapore can be an important hub, and I want to show you one example. When China's Belt and Road Initiative became important, we identified Southeast Asia need infrastructure. So we proposed to the government to start a statutory board making Singapore the infrastructure development investment financing hub for the Belt and Road Initiative. See, this is a classic example of what Mr. Lee Kuan Yew said, to make yourself relevant. So we make ourselves a hub for Belt and Road Initiative. So there are five basic principles for public policy formulation I shared with you, which is, I think, I will end in 5 minutes, right? Firstly, our public policy are pragmatic. They are not reliant on textbook cases. They have to be unique and look at Singapore circumstances. So no following of textbook cases. Now in Bhutan, I haven't been there. I also don't know that what kind of a development model, but certainly I think you should not follow just the textbooks. You must have an open mind. And number two, Singapore as a strategic hub for international trade and services, we must reinforce that. We must make this a top priority in our national building. Then zero tolerance for corruption, for financial reward to exchanging power for favors. This one is a must. This is the five principles of public policy. I would say this may be the most important. An inclusive society, I talk about. Preserving the democratic system which allows for checks and balance. I think democracy is, but we shouldn't have a two-party system. So how civil servants avoid group things, how public at large can be engaged to be outward-looking. Okay, and so now how we should, you know, elevate the income disparity, then improve upper social mobility. Now this is the fourth generation leader now they want to do, to make sure that taxi drivers' father can have the son to become ministers. So upper social mobility is very important. Then social integration. So I would not go into too much on this. Then finally, about the 4G leadership. And the leadership currently is going well. And they are now still trying to find out what will be the best way to engage Singaporeans going forward for another 30 years. So this one, I wrote it as a editorial opinion in a Straits Time, but I leave it for you to read. I will not go into this detail. And I want to leave more questions, time for question and answer. And ultimately, I think the final one, can Singapore not to choose side between China and USA? I think yes, we can. But we must periodically remind the major power the four core interests of Singapore, which is Singapore will support and synergize on regional economic development of Asian neighbors, including Bhutan. Singapore is committed to zero tolerance for corruption, whether it's in the government and the transparency of corporate governance in multinational. Singapore treats peaceful geopolitical stability and freedom of navigation in the Asian region, and Singapore is a strong supporter of globalization. We inclusive grow and we defend rule-based global trading system. These are our core interests. So that is why you see Singapore initiated the TPP, which is together now become CPTPP, the ASEAN-centric RCEP. We support these. So globalization now is reaching a peak, is slowing down. So we have to watch the trend. And the world debt crisis is getting worse than the Second World War for both developing and emerging economies. We have to be very careful. I think I will end my talk here by quoting Lee Kuan Yew. Lee Kuan Yew said this in 1988. Even from my sick back, even if you are going to lower me to the grave, I feel something is going wrong. I will get up now. When Lee Kuan Yew said this, what he meant is, as a leader, he's committed to public policy. Of course, he can't get up, you know, but the point he wanted to say is this. As a leader, you're committed to good public policy. And I will stop here, Mr. Chairman, and I hope we can take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor, for the excellent and very comprehensive presentation, covering many aspects and very relevant points for Bhutan. I will not try to summarize, but I think now I think we end the presentation from the professor here. And thank you, Professor, for making within 1 hour. I think you just took 56 minutes to complete the presentation.
Thank you.
145 slides. Now, coming to the question and answer session, there are two ways to do it. One is that we can raise hands. Those who are visible on the screen, you can raise hands, and then I will sequence them according to your sequence of posting the questions. And then another way to do it is also through the slido.com. And the password is, I think, displayed on the screen now. So if you go to slido.com, then you'll be taken to this group. And the number passcode is 24253133. And you can type your question there. And if everybody don't want to type questions, you can also see what others are typing. And if you like one question that somebody has typed, then you can raise your hand so that it becomes priority for us. Having said that, if we also find questions that are highly relevant, then we'll also pick up and post it to Professor for providing responses. And in order to start, I have one question from the group. I think this is highly relevant. Professor, the question says, you seem to advocate political stability through single-party democracy. How does that conform to the norms of democracy and political choices? So this is the question that has come from the group. Yeah. And you can kindly answer to that question first. Thank you.
Well, I'm not advocating one party system, but I'm saying that we can have two parties, checks and balance, but I would not like to see the two-party system where these are about 50-50. And we have seen this in the United States. We have seen it in the United Kingdom, how precious times are wasted. But for big countries, they can waste time. For small countries, I rather want to see a stable government with long continuity to make sure public policy are implemented. You know, very often, public policy will not show its effect in 5 years. Look at Marina Bay Sands as an integrated resort. Now it's 10 years. All the doubts are put to rest. Employment are created. Crimes are not getting worsened. You know, and Singapore's tourist arrival, you know, improved so much. But you see, you need 10 years. Now it's 12 years since the integrated resort starts. So if you have a two-party system, and one say, no, we shouldn't have integrated resort because I'm religious, casino is bad, although this is part of it. Some will say, no, I want to concentrate on the employment of the people. So if you have a strong government who can drive the direction, you can have checks or balance from opposition. For example, no, my family members, they're compulsive gamblers, I want to stop them from going. Yes, you can. So I'm not arguing one-party system. I'm saying that you have a dominion parties with the opposition to check on it. So this I will consider an ideal system because it allows policy continuity with minimum disruptions. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. I think while our colleagues are still thinking about their questions, maybe if I can just ask one question at this stage. Professor, you talked about the role of public institutions at different phases of economic development. My question relates to the role of culture, the tradition, the strategic location of Singapore, for example, the talents, leadership, I think you just mentioned. What did they play in achieving overall national economic development goals? So if you can just throw some light on that, Professor.
Well, I think in the early stage of Singapore development, there are not too many able civil servants. So you have able civil servants like Philip Yeo or Sim Kee Boon who lead the development. But at a different stage of development, when Singapore become more educated, the civil servants will consist of people who don't just implement, but also can think. So you see, as you develop over different stages, as the people become more educated, the kind of civil service, the role of civil servant also change. The civil servants now, as they are more educated, they should be integrated and be part of the policy-making processes, which you can't find them in the early stage of development. So if I get your question correctly, I say civil service must transform how they work, not just implementation, but now when the new media is so widespread, I think civil servant must also be good at articulating and communicating public policy. Not just formulate good public policy, but they must be able to convince the people. They must be able to explain public policy to ordinary citizens. So you see now civil servants as Singapore come to this stage where become more developed and the media are so widespread, civil servants' role from early stage just take instruction from the senior civil servant, then be part of the formulations by civil servants on policies. And now later, all civil servants must be able to explain policy through the social media, through the newspaper or the forum page where citizens sometimes may complain. So you must explain. So the nature of civil servant will change as the development stages change from a country from the early to the later stage. Did I understand? Is that what you're asking?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Professor. I think it's very clear.
Thank you.
We have another question from the group. Professor, can you please elaborate how Singapore created a big, stable middle class to overcome income disparity? So that's okay. The question that has come from the group.
Okay. You know, stable middle class. You know, if the economy grow, the GDP grow, you must have a mechanism how this growth can be shared. And you know that Singapore did this through the public housing and the forced saving or central provident fund. So you see, many Singaporeans bought their HDB at the east coast of Singapore, Marine Parade, near the East Coast Park. They bought it at the time for 30,000. 30,000 only, you know, 30,000 Singapore dollars in the 70s. For 99 years. But now, every unit worth near 1 million and sometimes sea view worth more than 1 million. So this is a middle class we created through the housing development policy, public housing, and the central provident fund. You can't find this in the textbook. There's no forced saving in the textbook. But you see, this is one mechanism that if you make the city livable, as the economy grow, the GDP become bigger, the economy cake become bigger, the sharing of the cake is through the appreciation of public housing and the appreciation of your saving with a positive return, which help to fund your public housing. And then we make sure that education is a social equalizer. Now, I think Singapore government under People's Action Party have achieved at least three policy, I would say, contribute to a big middle class. Number one, the People's Action Party can say there's no Singaporean who cannot afford to have a home to stay with roof over the top. So now we 85% owning public housing. So the first objective is achieved. And this is middle class. You own your apartment. More than 80% Singaporeans own their apartment, and the price is appreciated to very often now more than $1 million Singapore dollars. Now, this is one way of creating middle class. Now, education. People's Action Party is able to say that there's no one in Singapore who are capable of studying but stop education because they cannot afford it. So if you have poor family, there's a bursary. There's scholarships if you are poor. So you see, no Singaporean who want to study capable and cannot afford because of their poor. So education will achieve that. Now we want to achieve the third one, which we are about to achieve. There's no Singaporean who are sick and cannot afford healthcare. Now I must share with you, recently my wife and I, because we have our insurance coverage, whenever we need medical treatment, we go to private hospital. To my horror, both my wife and I, we went to government's polyclinic. You know, for the checkup, I used to pay for $2,000, but I went to the polyclinic. I was charged $28. I was just shocked. You know, some people go to polyclinic, they get charged for $10 or $2 if you're older. So you see, we have now come to a point that all Singaporeans who are not well can afford medical care. So these are important three factors where you are middle class. And of course, transportation, buses and MRT is very convenient. And yesterday they just announced another MRT across the island. So you see, a middle class must be able to find education, housing, healthcare, transportation affordable. But all these come with investment because you need investment in education. And you need government to build the public housing with the government fund. And you need to build hospital. You need to build MRT. But where we get the money? I told you, a prudent government with government surpluses invest through GIC and Tabase and help to subsidize the budget. So he enlarged our middle class. So you can see these are not market forces. These are role of the government. I believe, you know, you have a good leaders, which means you have to have good government and a good civil servant, because the leader will pick good civil servants. And having no resources or being in isolated place like Bhutan, there's no excuse for not being able to provide a very good middle class. So I think leadership and the civil servants to think outside the box, not based on textbook case. You can have a middle class, and a big middle class, 80%, will be so stable because middle class will not work opposition. Because if you vote opposition, if there's too much argument about public policy and their investment not coming, you see their property price decline. They are worried. So therefore, they vote for continuity. They vote for a government with which we have good track record. And this is how you keep one strong dominant party with the opposition checking, and then you can have a middle class through good public policies, generated government surplus to help to subsidize for those who are less capable. So this is an inclusive society. And middle class, but we shouldn't be jealous of people that top 1% that are very rich. Some people are fortunate. They're born into, in Singapore, born into a family of bungalows worth 30 million. You are instantly the 1% well-owning class. But we shouldn't be jealous. And I think we should allow the market mechanism to work. But the role of the government is to correct the market mechanism in such a way that it helps to contribute to a big middle class. Not just middle class, a big middle class of 80%.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. Anybody from the group here wanted to raise oral questions? So far, we have been only asking questions from the Slido.
Well, that's the problem with the kind of online things, you know. this is our experience. Nothing the same as face-to-face.
So I think while they are still thinking about the question, I think the one more question that has come is, I think the one difference between Bhutan and Singapore is the landlockedness of Bhutan. So the question is, how can Bhutan, being a landlocked country, make itself relevant to the world, considering its economy, its technological know-how, and resources? So this is the question that has come from the Slido again.
Well, with my limited understanding of Bhutan, but I think over the last 20 years, Bhutan has become less landlocked than it used to be. Because when you are landlocked, you are physically landlocked. But now with all this media, with the internet, with the WhatsApp, you are less landlocked. And this is through technology. And you can be known by people more easily. If your air transport become a more convenient way, you know, like for example, you must have direct flight, you know, from Bhutan to somewhere else. But then you have to build the airport. I cannot see how you build a seaport. You're too far away from the ocean. So you can build airport and then you are less landlocked. And then how to justify economic viability for direct flight? So to some extent, you need the tourism. But how to have green tourism? So if you have a good airport, I think it becomes less landlocked. But you have these internet facilities, you are able to be rich, you know, more easily than you used to be by land transport. And I think, you know, if the leaders of Bhutan think less of being landlocked physically, and I think opening up of a country with all this media accessibility. Now, no country in the world is so easy to lock themselves. You know, you may be physically landlocked, but I think when it comes to your people reaching to the people outside. Well, by the way, I don't think that Bhutan is so landlocked than it used to be. Last week, there is a Singaporean friend, my friend's daughter, married to a Bhutan man who studied in NUS. You know, there's a wedding, you know. I say, hey, where you from? Bhutan, where you study NUS? Ah, so now they're having business. And the Singaporean wife, which is my friend's daughter, he said he wants to do business, maybe tourism business. So you have a Bhutan man marry a Singaporean lady, and they want to go back to Bhutan. They are doing well in Singapore in terms of businesses. So I think, and I heard of cases of many Singaporeans also decided to marry to a Bhutan man and stay in Bhutan. So if you have interaction of people more, you become less landlocked. So interaction of people to people connectivity, internet technology connectivity, air connectivity, I think you can become less landlocked. And education overseas is also one way to overcome the landlocked. You know, if the Bhutan man don't come to study in National University of Singapore, he wouldn't be able to meet the Singaporean lady, right?
We have many more such cases, Professor.
Yes. So I must go and visit Bhutan one day, and I bring my pair of twins. You know, I have a pair of twins, a boy and a girl. They are 23 years old. Never know, I bring them to Bhutan, you know, maybe.
They may not come back to Singapore.
Yeah. I think, you know, Bhutan is such a mysterious place that we heard so much, we've never been there. I must go there once in my lifetime, at least.
Okay, professors, now we have somebody from the panel members who wanted to raise questions. Okay. So, Doji Dadul, who is the Director General of Tourism Council of Bhutan. Doji?
Ah.
Doji, you have to unmute.
Thank you, Dasho. And thank you, Professor. Thank you very much for this very enlightening, inspiring talk. And I've been really prompted to interact here because Professor has mentioned time and again tourism here. So as most of us in Bhutan, we know now tourism has actually changed in a way from the past. Now we are really looking tourism as a national strategic asset, basically saying that we will not depend totally on tourism, or we will not depend too much on the tourism as our main economic driver, but it will be there by default. So the question that I want to ask the professor is, what was the role tourism played in Singapore's development, starting from the initial stages in the early 60s and going right to present date? I mean, what was the role that tourism has been playing in the overall makeup of the Singapore's development journey so far?
Well, from the year 2000 onwards, since I was a consultant advisor to the Singapore Tourism Board, I think we want to get tourists to come to Singapore because the middle class around Southeast Asia is getting bigger. Middle class in China, Korea and Japan is getting bigger. So we thought this is a good potential industry where they provide services, which means that the high value added will allow people in the hospitality industry to be paid higher. And they are employment creations. And we have decided that it has come to a point that Singapore should tap on the middle class in Asia, including India too. So, but the question is, what kind of middle class and what kind of tourism that we want? Some people say tourism, no integrated resort please, because there is casino. And we say that's silly. If there are billion of dollar investment just because of casino, the vices can be controlled. So we think of what kind of tourism. For Singapore, we think shopping hub. Singapore as a hub to recent surrounding natural beauties. So, if you ask me about Bhutan tourism, I'm thinking of hospitality industry with green tourism must be what Bhutan can do, and also spiritual tourism that many people look towards to Bhutan to relax spiritually. You can have a spa, meditation, which are green and not polluting. So hospitality management means that more Bhutanese speak English. But I think the chairman, all of you, your command of English is better than me, not just in terms of pronunciation, but in the language you use. So I think, so you want a tourism, firstly, people must find Bhutan interesting. Now you have, actually Bhutan, I think you have a natural resources, your asset. That means your location is such a nice place. That's your natural advantage. And then your religion is another natural advantage. But how can you make the ecosystem that you have a tourism that is consistent with your religion? You have a tourism that is harmonious to your environment, and you have a tourism that People find them interesting that offering things that Singapore cannot offer. So there's no substitute for tourism to Bhutan and Singapore. I think so. So, I don't know, organic agriculture part of the tourism can also be something that you can have. I don't know about the wildlife. So I think this need long-term planning, not just piecemeal, I do this, I do that. I think a master plan for tourism ought to be drawn and looking at the market that you want. And I'm sure Bhutan, you cannot look at the mass tourism market because they will kill all your plants. The grass all will be stepped. You must go for higher value added, not the mass public tourists, you know. Now, in Singapore, we learned in terms of tourism, for example, Marina Bay Sands and Resort World. Marina Bay Sands started as a higher value-added, business-oriented, integrated resort. And Resort World at Sentosa started as more family-oriented, a holiday resort. And now we found the profit of Marina Bay Sands is twice the profit of Resort World in Sentosa. And you look at the shopping, you look at the restaurant, you look at the visitors, they are higher spending power in Marina Bay Sands than Resort World. So it reflects on their profitability, it reflects on the positioning and the content of the integrated resort industry. And the kind of tourists attracted to Marina Bay Sands and the kind of tourists attracted to Resort World. So I am sure Bhutan as a small country with the advantage of your land, you don't want to have mass tourist arrival. You want to be selective. Not necessarily the richest, but those who willing to pay for the kind of the green tourism, the spiritual tourism, organic agriculture tourism, hospitality industry, where the five-star hotel is not the tallest building, but the most eco-friendly. So I'm sure the master plan of Bhutan tourism can be figured out very, very carefully. And you must have a master plan for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years development. And therefore, you need a government. I'm not familiar with the Bhutan system. What is the point to have a 30-year tourism plan and 5 years later, you find your government being pauper, you know? Then a different idea came in. I don't know. I don't know about Bhutan. How strong is your government? Are you a two-party system? Yes. Or you are having a strong government with weak opposition? I don't know. The director of tourism, you can enlighten me.
We are a two-party system, finally.
I hope it's not 50-50.
Sometimes the opposition can be very weak. Sometimes the opposition can be very strong also.
You have an unstable democracy, yeah?
I think the takeaway from Professor's response that in the tourism, we cannot really compare between Singapore and Bhutan. I think this is what he's trying to convey. The next professor, the one challenge that we have been recently facing in Bhutan is we are losing a lot of working class people to overseas jobs. And Professor mentioned that it is important to retain talent pool significantly for economic growth. So in this regard, what can Bhutan do to retain the talent pool by preventing those leaving the country and going abroad?
Okay, I share with you. On this question, I share with you a relevant case study. You know, President Xi Jinping's father, President Xi Zhongxin, he was a party secretary for Guangdong. And Guangdong bordering Hong Kong. And he fed back to Deng Xiaoping then. He said, there are so many people from Guangdong swimming across to Hong Kong, even at the risk of being eaten up by sharks. So he said that something is very wrong. Why people want to leave Guangdong to go to Hong Kong by swimming in the shark-infested ocean? So he says something is very wrong with the economy structure of Guangdong. And one way is to stop people from going to Hong Kong is to give them a good, meaningful, and well-remunerated job in Guangdong. And now, I don't think Guangdong people would like to swim to Hong Kong. because Guangdong now become more developed than Hong Kong. So more Hong Kong people are not attracted to Guangdong now. About Bhutan, if you say that you are facing the labor shortage, now I think you have to analyze the kind of people who left Bhutan to work overseas, are they blue collar or not? If they are blue collar, it means that they get higher salary even as a blue collar, low paid worker in outside Bhutan. So that's why I say you have to give them employment that they find as a low paid blue collar worker overseas. It's not attractive to them being blue collar and better paid in at home together with the family. So I think that part you have to think through. Now I don't know that the Bhutanese that who left are the blue collar or white collar. Now, if you are saying that the white collar also leaving, then I think you must develop job opportunities for bright Bhutanese to be in the white collar jobs. And therefore, if you cannot retain both the white collar and the blue collar Bhutanese, then I would say that your economy cannot deliver the kind of expectation and aspiration of Bhutanese. That's why they're leaving. So therefore, you know, in Singapore, we attracted so many Malaysians to come to Singapore. Why? Because we deliver more than what our people can aspire to. So much so that we have more jobs than our people, so we have to take foreigners, you see. So I think this, to me, is a structural problem. If you're talking about white collar, blue collar, Bhutanese living and to work overseas. So we must think of how ways to keep, no, not to say to keep the foreign talent, but keep the local people. Because if you ask me, most countries, people rather don't want to work overseas, you know. Even in China, I'll give you an example. Guangdong used to attract workers from other provinces. They're also Chinese. But later on, when other inner provinces start to develop, although the wages is lower, but most people say, I'd rather stay in my province, slightly lower wages. I can be with my family. I don't want to work in another province outside my hometown. So I think you have to monitor the cost of living, monitor the purchasing power, monitor the public services, monitor the public housing. That can we deliver this to the Bhutanese people? If we cannot, they go overseas to make the money and they come and find the housing affordable. Now, this is what is happening to Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan. They're willing to come to Singapore at the wages much lower than what Singaporeans would take. But they're quite happy. Why? Because they become better off than the Bangladesh or Indian or Pakistan who never go abroad. And they can afford housing through the salary outside. And same is for Philippines, for Indonesia. They all come to work overseas in Singapore because that put them in the advantage to purchase houses locally, to purchase land locally. So if you ask me if there is such a situation in Bhutan where the people, whether white collar, blue collar, go abroad, that means there's not enough development.
Thank you, Professor. There's a follow-up question on managing the cost of living. How can government intervene to control or manage the cost of living? There's a question from the Slido.
Yeah. You know, cost of living can be managed. You see, Singapore cost of living, in terms of expatriate cost, we rank top 5 in the world. But in terms of cost of living for ordinary residents, we rank 51 in 100 over cities. So people ask, you know, how can your cost of living for expatriate is so high, sometimes number 3rd in the world among 100 over cities? But every year, your cost of living for ordinary Singaporeans is 51, 53 among 100 cities. This is the work of the government. You notice in Singapore, in every 5, 10 blocks of public housing, we have a hawker center. We allow perfect competition for hawker centers so that the hawkers, if you raise the price too high for your chicken rice, people just go to 5 blocks away or 10 blocks away. So by having more competition with hawker centers built by the government at a subsidized rate, so we keep the cost of living, at least food, for ordinary Singaporean cheaper. And then for the expatriate, they eat in a restaurant. Or they eat in a food court, which is much, much more expensive than hawker center. And then we have public housing near the hawker centers so that your transportation costs will be low. After work, you come home, you eat at the hawker center, you walk back to your house. So your cost of living is low. Unlike in many European countries, you know, to eat in a restaurant, you have to take an MRT. So when the housing is near to the food centers and there are competition for the hawkers, and I think you have to keep the cost of living low. And then, of course, utility, water. Now, this one, no point subsidizing the water because water is very expensive. And electricity. So we will charge electricity, water, and market price. But for the poorest 20%, government will give them subsidies or rebates on their utility. So you see, government have to come in to make sure cost of living not going higher. It must be affordable. But the government must have the money. A government that's bankrupt, the government that's living on debt, there's no way you can control the cost of living. You don't have the resources to cushion the poorest 20%. So you ask me the question, how government can manage the cost of living? Firstly, this government must have a prudent budget. And government must intervene in the infrastructure in such a way. You know, I also go to hawker center almost every day. Now today, after this talk, I have no more engagement. I go to hawker center to have my chicken rice, $4.50. And sometimes I look at it, you know. A worker, I make 20 times a month more than this worker, but he's paying $4 of chicken rice as me. So I find the cost of living for me is too low. But why is too low? Because I don't go to restaurant. I go to hawker center, not even the food court. But this guy, find the $4 is too expensive because it's in the lowest 20%. So government must come in to help him. But meanwhile, you cannot stop me from going to the hawker centers. And so very frankly, I can tell you, I spend only 16% of my total income. The rest is saving. Why? Because I don't buy a new Mercedes every year. I buy a new one, I use it for 10 years. I don't buy a big bungalow, you know. I don't drive expensive car. I don't go to expensive restaurant. So cost of living to me is so low. And I'm an upper middle class. So if a middle class say, I don't want to own a car, I take MRT, then of course, your cost of living is low. So making cost of living low is not just government, but you must make a decision, an informed decision, that your cost of living must commensurate with your ability to earn your income. So if you are middle class, you say, I don't want to have a car, then your cost of living is lower. And if you are middle class, you don't need to send your children to piano, swimming, karate, computer tuition, then your cost is low. So you see, managing cost of living is two sides of the coins. Government who can afford to help those who are the lowest 20% is one thing, but middle class, you must spend according to your means. Not to live beyond your means, then your cost of living is very high. So if you are middle class, you are not rich, so don't drink every day. Drink once a month. Instead of smoking 2 packets cigarette a day, try not to smoke or smoke 2 sticks a day. You know, you can cut down on this because alcohol and cigarette are the most expensive in the world, and the cars. So you see, just how you say what the government can do, but I say you should also think what the people can do to make your cost of living lower, which is control your aspiration, control your expectation, and you find in life, cost of living is not such a difficult challenge to manage.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. We have now RICS Director, Dasawang. Dasawang?
Thank you. Professor, thank you so much for that very, very enlightening talk and discussions happening
thank
right
you.
Now. I would like to ask a slightly different question Earlier you mentioned about the importance of having good political leaders on one hand and a strong civil service on the other to actually, achieve not only economic success, but so many other successes in nation building. So often we find in democracies this dynamics or the tension between political masters and the bureaucrats. So from Singapore's experience, I'm just wondering how that politico-administrative kind of dynamics is managed so that the tension in a way becomes more creative tension, or it is strengthened for Singapore to achieve what it aspires to achieve. So if you could shed some light on that. Thank you.
Yeah, on this, you will notice middle rank civil servants and the senior rank civil servants in Singapore, they are always being sent abroad for their second degree. For them to be overseas, and when they come back as a civil servant, they see things in a different way. Just for me, I spent 9 years in England for my bachelor, master, and PhD. When I come back, I know welfare state is bad. Why? Because I see how the government in London become bankrupt. So you see, civil servants must be exposed to overseas. If not for degree, at least for short-term courses, executive, so that they see things in a different perspective. I think that's one thing. And your civil servants, having the kind of experience abroad, and I think you also have to think of, your civil servant have to be paid reasonably good for them to want to come back and want to be in the government. So you pay peanuts, you get monkeys, So in that sense, Singapore civil servant, because the pay is quite good and they have to be innovative and make good policies. Otherwise, people are eyeing their jobs, If you are a senior director, it's very well paid in Singapore. So I'm just saying that if you are a civil servant, firstly, you must have overseas experience to see how it's different from home. And I even suggested this to the government. We should send those Singaporeans who supported opposition, send them to India, send them to Philippines, send them to Indonesia and Malaysia for short-term holidays, for them to see how the public services there are so bad. So they come back, they appreciate. So you see, so in other words, that Singaporeans are the most widely traveled, one of the most widely traveled citizens in the world. So when we see what's overseas, we come home, we appreciate. And I think these are for the people, but for the civil servant, you really need to let them have at least a short span of their time abroad. For them to value, maybe they go to see the pollution in Indonesia or in Bangkok, then they know how fresh airs are so important in Bhutan, I hope I answer your question, right? So in other words, I'm just saying that you cannot have a poorly paid civil servant who have not seen the world and they are limited to Bhutan and their mindset cannot be open. Now, just now, I was a little bit worried that you say your political system is sometimes opposition strong, sometimes opposition is weak. Usually, political supporters, they are quite stable. If you have this fluctuation, which means that your media is very important, how they contribute to this kind of fluctuation in popular votes. Singapore's media, I don't think they are controlled, but they are guided. Social media, I don't think they are controlled, but they are guided. You make irresponsible remarks on new media, you'll be asked to be corrected or you'll be charged. So ordinary people depend on new media for information. But if your new media is a free for all, I think it contributes to chaotic situation at home. And nowadays, I think many people go to the media, they can't differentiate what is fake news, what is true news. So I don't know, if your political system, the opposition government and the ruling party fluctuate, maybe you need very good leaders who can be a stabilizer, who can provide a long-term view, that to convince the people that this is a good policy package, that they will see through the policies. So you don't have that government in and out. Back in my PowerPoints, Lee Kuan Yew said that if you have government in and out, you can't fix it, you know. Once it's broken, take many years to repair and you never get back to the original. So having opposition up and down or ruling party up and down, I think it's not favorable for progressive and stable development, whether it's socially, economically, or politically. You may not agree with me, but I'm just saying that I'm being pragmatic now. I look at the Singapore's development. I think having a middle class and a government that stay in power for a long time, I think is very important. You know, when I was young, I was socialist, near communist. When I was in the UK for 9 years, I become very democratic and westernized. But as I grow older, I say, oh no, freedom without responsibility. Oh no, popularity of the government to spend money and make the budget bankrupt. So I start to think a very pragmatic one. You know, all this democracy cannot be, I don't know about Bhutan. You know, in Taiwan, when democracy was trust to the people so fast, and people start to react to the democracy that they are not ready. So you see the chaos in Taiwan. So I believe even Singapore, we are opening up gradually. Our democracy are not opening up immediately. After 50 over years, we are more democratic, more open than the past, but the speed is slow, not too quick. And I think we have seen places when the speed is too quick and it's disastrous. You end up with a two-party system who are not responsible, but just to get a popular vote so that I last for 5 years. So you don't think long-term. This is what I worry most. For a small country like Bhutan. Huh?
Thank you, Professor. Now we are into the last minute of our Q&A session. And as a moderator, I think I thought that maybe I'll just post the last question and maybe then I think we will wrap up. I have to apologize to many Slido participants that there were so many other questions that is still there, but we'll not have time to answer to all the questions. But we hope that we'll have another opportunity with Professor in near future to clarify some of the pertinent issues that they have come up with.
When I come to Bhutan.
Yeah, maybe a professor can come to Bhutan. I have one question regarding the state intervention in the economy versus the private sector involvement. If I'm allowed to quote the joke that in Singapore, it is said that the government is the business. The example being that Thammasat, for example, has made range of investment in across the businesses. So my question is that, where did Singapore draw the lines of state intervention in the economy versus promoting private sector development? So if you can just throw some light on that and then we'll wrap up.
You know, I'm glad you asked these questions because Milton Friedman, Nobel laureate, came to Singapore in 1985, debated with our Deputy Prime Minister Goh Keng Swee on the question you just raised. Milton Friedman said, look, whether you call it governmentally company or state-owned enterprise, they cannot do better than the private sector. And our Deputy Prime Minister Goh Keng Swee said, no, I don't agree with you. Singapore Airlines is a governmentally company, or you can call it state-owned company if you like. DBS Bank, but we did very well. So you know what? The Nobel laureate, Milton Friedman said, you did very well because Lee Kuan Yew and you are around. One day, Lee Kuan Yew and Dr. Goh Keng Swee, you're not around. State-owned enterprise, governing companies will be corrupt, will be inefficient, will lose money. Now, Lee Kuan Yew passed away 2015, almost 7 years. Goh Keng Swee passed away even more than 10 years. Our Development Bank of Singapore, our governing companies, many of them still very profitable. CapitaLand, Singapore Airlines. So it is not true that state-owned companies is worse and private sector corporation is better. I think it's in the management. And I can tell you this, that you think that state-owned company must lose money, but you forgot state-owned company have an advantage, or you can put the government resources together. Now, I give you this example. You think Singapore Airlines doing so well? That's because of Changi Airport. Changi Airport is supported by the government, designed very much for Singapore Airlines. So with this government resources coming, one pocket to the other. One is the corporatized Changi Airport, help the privatized Singapore Airlines with government as a biggest minority shareholder. So you can see a governing company or state-owned company can still do well. So now the question is not about private enterprise or state-owned enterprise. It's the people who run it. Are these people professional? Are they corrupt? You know, are they picked by the market, or they are picked because they are linked to leadership? They are relative of leadership. They are not the best people for the job. So you see, one should not. This is a textbook case. Milton Friedman is a textbook case. They say state-owned enterprise, governing company, you'll be less efficient than private corporation. This is a textbook. But Singapore has shown exceptions. Even after our Deputy Prime Minister, Dr. Goh Keng Swee, passed away, our Minister Mentor Lee Kuan Yew passed away, our governing companies, they're still very efficient. Even Temasek, you can look at Temasek as a big state-owned company with more than $1 trillion of assets. Do we have a big scandal in Temasek? No. But we are going stronger from strength to strength. But why? Leadership is very important. The best man for the best job. So let's not to fix our mind on a textbook about debate between state-owned enterprise and private corporation. They each have their own advantage, right? But if you want to ensure the interests of the government, certain industry, I think it's better to be government-owned or government-linked with a big stake in the company. And I can tell you this. If Singapore Airlines is not owned by Singapore government as the biggest minority shareholder, when it comes to a war, how can you convert Singapore Airlines passenger planes to cargo planes? A private airline will negotiate how much you pay for me. Now, with the Singapore Airlines as government-owned, then it makes justification to use Changi Airport resources to help Singapore Airlines, because if Singapore Airlines become profitable, the money belongs to the taxpayer. So you see, management of DBS Bank and Changi Airport, they are marketized because they are listed. The CEO are picked from the market, but if the CEO don't fulfill certain criteria of the government, the board can remove the CEO. So DBS Bank must look after the interests of small and medium enterprises. Singapore Airlines must help to promote Changi as a regional aviation hub, which stimulates the economy. I'm a consultant for Changi Airport. We found that Changi Airport contributed to 25% of the total demand in Singapore. That means direct demand, induced demand, and indirect demand. But why Changi Airport is so important to the Singapore economy? Because we have a Singapore airline. So now we are building Terminal 5. Should we stop? No. Aviation industry is going to explode. So we have a Terminal 5. So you see, then we have a Singapore airline which we must support because it helped to make Singapore aviation hub. So if you have a state-owned company or government-owned company, whatever you call, they must also have agenda for the national interest. So I call this Singapore Airline Development Bank of Singapore Corporation with strategic national interest in mind. Now this is nothing new. In the United States, if Abu Dhabi or United Arab Emirates want to buy certain port, U.S. say, oh no, this is for security reason, you cannot buy national security. So what's wrong with that? So let's not make our mind very narrow in the either or binary, either state-owned enterprise or private sector. I think it can be a mix of both, it can be a hybrid, depending on what industry. Certain industry, like MRT, our MRT is better. You know, state-owned public transport is a national monopoly. Imagine we have had too many MRT systems. We can't be efficient for a small country, right? I hope I'm making this very clear. Let's don't rely on textbook argument about one way or the other. Okay, we look at the industry, and we look at the stage of development, and we look at the uniqueness of Singapore as a hub, then we can decide what is the best national interest and what is good for the private sector market.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. I think with this, as I said earlier, I would like now to close the Q&A session. And in doing so, on behalf of all the participants and on my own behalf, I would like to thank Dr. Tan immensely for not only delivering an excellent and inspiring talk on various factors that contributed to Singapore's economic achievements, which are relevant to Bhutan, but also answering all the wonderful questions that our participants had posted. With the very little knowledge that we gained from your talk today and the experiences you shared through responses to various questions, I hope that it will go a long way in contributing positively to Bhutan's major economic transformation and reforms that we just embarked upon. I'd like to once again thank Rix for giving me the honor to be moderator for today's talk. And last but not the least, I'd like to thank our wonderful audience for their patient listening and asking wonderful and highly relevant questions. I would
and,
now.
And if you do come to Singapore, you're welcome.
Thank
Please
you.
Please call my mobile. I buy you dinner at Din Tai Fung, of which I'm an independent director. I get a 20% discount. So call me when you're in Singapore. All of you in Bhutan now, or some of you in Singapore?
No, we are in Bhutan. All of us in Bhutan.
All of you. And have any one of you been to Singapore? I know one person study in Singapore. So all of you have been to Singapore.
We have been to Singapore, yes.
Oh, that's
and
good.
I can see one minister sitting there who studied from Singapore also.
So please come to Singapore. I bring you to the top 10 restaurant voted in New York. That's Din Tai Fung. It's a Singapore company, and I'm in the board. So if you come,
your cost of living might go up then if you come down, because you have to us in the expensive restaurants.
No, I have to promote, you know, Din Tai Fung. So next time people from Bhutan, they come to Singapore, we must go to Din Tai Fung, you know. So the chairman has already assigned to me a special red wine cooler. If you have a friend's VIP wine cooler with the red wine from the chairman, you know.
Okay. Thank you, Professor, for your offer.
And
before we close, I would like to hand over to Ms. Sonam Yangden, who is the Media and Public Relations Officer of RICS, to propose the formal vote of thanks. And then
I forgot to take a picture of this. I must take a picture so that at least I see you virtually. Thank you.
Sonam, maybe you want to now close.
Yes, thank you. Honourable Prime Minister, Ministers, Governor of the Royal Monetary Authority, Secretaries, Dr. Tham Kea Gia, ladies and gentlemen, wish you all a very good afternoon. Firstly, on behalf of the Institute and our audience, I would like to extend my heartfelt gratitude to our esteemed speaker, Dr. Tham Kea Gia, for highlighting the factors behind Singapore's economic achievements and for engaging with our audience so meaningfully. I would also like to join my director in thanking Mr. Tommy Ho, the Ambassador at Large at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Singapore, for his very generous help in making this lecture series a possibility. As the editor of the book, 50 Secrets of Singapore's Success, Ambassador Tommy Ho prefaced as follows. I think the people of the world are hungry for good ideas and success stories. My hope is that the 50 success stories in this book will be of interest to people around the world. I hope that this book will inspire other countries to achieve their own dreams. And here we are, delving deeper into the stories behind Singapore's success to inspire ourselves to achieve our national dreams and aspirations. In what is a remarkable feat of the economic success of the 20th century as a nation, Singapore continues to grip the attention of the world as the fifth most competitive economy in the world, with its strong economic fundamentals, as mentioned by Dr. Tan Kea Gia. Its resilient and stable economy is one of the world's most progressive economies. Its high employment rate, world-class talent, future-ready infrastructure, strong digital capabilities, business-friendly environment, and global connectivity are all that we aspire to achieve as a small nation. As pointed out by our moderator, Singapore is called Asia's economic powerhouse for a reason, or for many reasons. As we experience a fundamental shift in the global economy with its multifaceted volatility and surprises, we can draw inspiration from the Singaporean economic model that has stood the test of time and continues to evolve towards becoming ever resilient and efficient. However, as we understand, we would also like to acknowledge for not always painting a rosy picture of the situation and addressing the elephants in the room. Some of this, as mentioned, are the worsening income and wealth disparity, unaffordable but essential public services, and fine balancing between indigenous and foreign manpower in an open economy in Singapore. These make us wary of our own developmental approaches and serve as valuable lessons as we aggressively pursue economic recovery and growth. As highlighted by Dr. Tham, the critical role of government as an economic facilitator, social equalizer, and political stabilizer cannot be understated. Therefore, we have no doubt our leaders and policymakers attending the talk today will take home, or rather take to work, valuable lessons and insights that will guide us in working on our current transformation journey. With some things in common yet so different, Singapore has dared us to hope, dream, and believe in the impossible, leaving little room to despair about our size and resources. By creating such a platform for discourse and idea sharing, RICS hopes to humbly complement the current reform initiatives entrusted to the people of Bhutan by His Majesty the King. For this, we would like to once again thank Dr. Tham Kiagyap for graciously consenting to deliver the lecture and for the very enriching Q&A session with the audience. We would also like to thank our moderator, the Secretary of the Ministry of Economic Affairs, Mr. Karma Srin, for doing a great job in making this lecture as interactive and educative as possible. Last but not the least, I extend our deepest gratitude and appreciation to the Honorable Prime Minister and all other dignitaries and participants for taking time out of your busy schedules to join the lecture today. It really means a lot to us, and we are grateful to the Prime. Thank you, and stay tuned for the third lecture in this series on learning from Singapore's success in combating corruption coming up same time tomorrow. Thank you.